If you're not sick or poor, what does Jesus have to do with you? Is religion really just a crutch for weak-minded people? Or is there something more? In this five-week series, you can find answers to the question, what is the good news for the person who has everything?
Do you have a favorite inspirational quote? It's kind of hard to get away from them, and even harder to escape the ideas behind them. You know, like that work hard, play hard thing. You can have anything if you just work hard enough. Nothing in life is free. Just keep going. A quick internet search yielded these gems. The greatest pleasure in life is doing what people say you cannot do. Genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Supposedly that's by Thomas Edison, but I have no idea if that's true. There are no shortcuts to any place worth going. Then how about this cold dose of reality from Tracy G? My Roman Empire is the fact that personal development books marketed to women are shelved in the self-help section, but books on similar topics marketed to men are in the leadership section. Weird, that. We're surrounded by the message of working and earning and personal development. So we bring it then to our faith. There's this temptation to try to earn our way into God's favor. And it's especially appealing to white middle-class people. Most of us from the time we were children have been told by our Depression era parents and grandparents that we have to work for what we want and that we can get whatever we want in life only by dedication and education and persistence. And many of us become so convinced of this that we begin to believe that hard work is the answer to all of our problems and our needs. Like I said, we bring this approach to our faith. When we come to worship then and we open our Bibles, and it looks like sometimes that hard work and grand gestures are valued. Like we open our Bibles to one of the accounts of Jesus' life and ministry, and we see the story of a man called the rich young ruler. And he came to Jesus asking, what do I need to do to be saved? And Jesus responds with a list of thou shalt nots, like thou shalt not murder, don't commit adultery, thou shalt not steal. And the guy is like, check, check, check. I've done all those things since I was young. And then Jesus adds something else. He says, go and sell everything you have and give the money to the poor. That's a grand gesture if I've ever heard one. And our minds then fill in the blanks, like surely I have to do something drastic to get God's love. Surely I have to make some grand gesture in order to prove to God how serious I am so that God will let me into the club. But the message of Jesus is good news about a status which we already have with God, which we don't need to earn and you can't work for. You can't work to earn the right to be your parents' child. You know, you already are that child. So the question we're facing is not, what can we do to get God to love us? The question is, what can we do in light of God's love for us? Like maybe Jesus was inviting the rich young ruler to live in response to God's love, in freedom from greed, in freedom from a scarcity mindset, in freedom from the need to earn God's love. What if you don't need to do anything to earn God's love? What if it's already yours? Because here's the thing, Jesus is the answer which makes our question, what must I do to be saved, irrelevant and unnecessary. We're in a series based on the book by Will Willimon, which is currently in our micro bookstore, and it's also for sale on Amazon. I'm sure you could order it through any of your favorite local bookstores. And this series is called The Good News for the Person Who Has Everything. And we began last week asking the question, do I have to be weak in order to receive this good news? Today we're learning about this good news, that it's already yours. Next week we'll discuss how the good news is a gift to be used, and then how the good news leads us to a life of gratitude. And finally, we'll ask if the good news is something we engage on my own. So today, I wonder how things would shift for you. How would your faith change if you came to the realization that you don't have to earn God's favor, that it's already yours? How would that change your faith? Like, what if it's only when we sense the permanence of God's love that we can recognize the fickleness that lives in us? What if it's only when we sense the truth in God that we can see the falsehood in ourselves? And what if only Christians can really be sinners? Because they're the ones who know just how much they're loved and can never really sense how much they've betrayed that love of God. Let's pause here for a chat question. Where have you noticed that message that you have to work hard to earn success or love? Turn to someone around you or put it in the chat. This message of hard work to earn things is all over the place. So let's look at a story that Jesus told that demonstrates the counterpoint that shows us that God's love is already yours. We're going to look at the parable of the two sons. In Luke's account of Jesus' life and ministry, he records Jesus telling this story. To illustrate the point further, Jesus told them the story. A man had two sons. The younger son told his father, "I want my share of your estate now, before you die." So his father agreed to divide his wealth between his sons. And a few days later, this younger son packed all his belongings and moved to a distant land. And there he wasted all his money in wild living. About the time his money ran out, a great famine swept over the land, and he began to starve. He persuaded a local farmer to hire him, and the man sent him into his fields to feed the pigs. The young man became so hungry that even the pods he was feeding the pigs looked good to him, but no one gave him anything. Now, there's some important context here. When the son asks for his inheritance before his father dies, he's essentially saying, "Your money is more important to me than our relationship, and I'm ready to call it. Like, I don't mind if I consider you dead from here on out." And then second, he went out and wasted all of his money. He was completely irresponsible. He had a ton of resources and he blew through it all. And then third, we don't really have an equivalent thing in our culture. We don't really have things that are taboo. So it's hard for us to understand the significance of the pigs that this son is feeding. This is shameful work. It's disgraceful. It's dirty. When he finally came to his senses, he came to himself. He said to himself, "At home, even the hired servants have food enough to spare, and here I am dying of hunger. I will go home to my father and say, 'Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy of being called your son. Please take me on as a hired servant.'" So he returned home to his father. When he came to his senses, he came to himself. Like, he has this realization that his father has resources. He recognizes that being a servant under his father's care and protection would be a better circumstance than where he's at right then. And at this point, he's ready to accept the role of a servant because he knows his father is the answer. And then while he was a long way off, his father saw him coming. Filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son, embraced him, and kissed him. His son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy of being called your son." But his father said to the servants, "Quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet, and kill the calf we have been fattening. We must celebrate with a feast, for this son of mine was dead and has now returned to life. He was lost, but now he is found." So the party began. The son came to himself, remembering his father's resources. Now the boy already had access to those resources as his father's son. He just hadn't been living like it. And now the son is ready to make amends, but the father runs out and meets him, leading with love. The father is far more interested in finally having his son back home than he is concerned with getting his son down on his knees in confession. The son expects to be treated like a pauper, but his father puts a ring on his finger and receives him like a prince. So This is the son's good news. The son remembers that the father is the answer. Now, at first, he doesn't remember that his father loves him, although his father does, but he knows that his father is the answer. He knows that the resources of the father will meet his needs. And second, the son senses his problem. He recognizes the fact that he's living more like a homeless pig than a son of his father. And finally, the son repents and turns toward home, finding that his father's love is deeper and more gracious than he ever imagined. Even though the son clearly has problems, the beginning of the story is realizing he already has the answer. The love of the father is already his. The position of son is already his. He didn't have to earn his father's love. And you don't have to earn God's love. It's already yours. If your life has obvious problems, Jesus is the answer, and he already loves you. And if your life is pretty good, Jesus is the answer, and he already loves you. And in either case, there's still an invitation for you to respond. The younger son had obvious problems and found that his father was the answer. He responds to his father's love by returning home and celebrating with his father. Now, the older son is experiencing his brother's return in a very different way. Meanwhile, the older son was in the fields working. When he returned home, he heard music and dancing in the house, and he asked one of the servants what was going on. "Your brother is back," he was told, "and your father has killed the fattened calf. We are celebrating because of a safe return." The older brother was angry and wouldn't go in. His father came out and begged him, but he replied, "All these years I've slaved for you and never once refused to do a single thing you told me to do. And in all that time, you never gave me even one young goat for a feast with my friends. Yet when this son of yours comes back after squandering your money on prostitutes, you celebrate by killing the fattened calf." The older brother's life was pretty good. He never left home. He shared in all of the material comfort of his father's estate. And he still had an opportunity to respond. And his father said to him, "Look, dear son, you've always stayed by me and everything I have is yours. We had to celebrate this happy day, for your brother was dead and has come back to life. He was lost, but now he's found." The younger son had obvious problems and his father was the answer and he already loved him. And the older son's life was pretty good and his father was the answer and he already loved him. Let's take a moment for another chat question. Take a moment just to reflect on the story of the two sons. What character do you resonate with most? Again, if your life has obvious problems, Jesus is the answer, and he already loves you. And if your life is pretty good, Jesus is the answer, and he already loves you. What would change in your life if the foundation of your faith was that Jesus is the answer and he already loves you? Well, I think it would lead to a more mature faith, one that's rooted in God's love for you. And this foundation changes everything. And in light of that, when Jesus says to his disciples that they must become like little children to enter into God's kingdom, I think that's about living as a child who knows deep down to their core that they're loved by their parents. Because you're not going to have a mature faith if you're not completely rooted in, grounded in God's love for you. So let's talk about immature versus mature faith. We're going to start with polarized thinking versus perspective taking. Polarized thinking is about not being stuck in either or, where things are either right or they're wrong and there's no in between. On the outside, this can look very confident, like we know the things. But inside, this way of thinking hides doubts. On the outside, it looks like having all the answers. But on the inside, there's this intolerance for not knowing things yet, which makes it difficult or impossible to learn new things. Perspective taking, on the other hand, is part of a faith that's so rooted in God's love that it's not threatened to consider other possibilities. This mature faith isn't threatened by things being nuanced and complicated and messy. This faith is willing to learn by considering other ideas, by stepping back to evaluate its own claims. And this is crucial because the reality is that life is messy. Life has hardships. Life will throw you curveballs that will disrupt the sense you've made out of life. And if you're not able to incorporate new information, to consider other ways of living out your faith, there's a good chance that something will break where it can't bend. And second, formulaic thinking versus freedom. Formulaic thinking is like saying A plus B equals C every time, no exceptions. So if I give a certain amount of money to the church and then I pray, then God will bless me beyond measure every time, no exceptions. And the problem of this way of thinking is twofold, at least. One, it's often weaponized in high control religious settings to manipulate folks into giving more than they can really afford, with the expectation that God will bless them in return. And two, miracles become not strange, unexpected, divine interventions into the pain of the world, but expected and bargained for rewards for saying the right things and believing the right ways. It turns miracles into magic. This is a way of forcing God's hand to do what you want God to do. That's not a relationship based on love and trust. It's honestly kind of selfish and self-serving. I do this and God does this. And freedom is the flip side of that. Out of a strong sense of God's love for us, we experience freedom from fear, knowing that God loves us even when we make mistakes. So then we try to do the right thing, not because we're afraid of getting in trouble, but because we've experienced abiding love and we want to share that with other people. This is freedom to be misunderstood, like to recognize that you're not going to be able to do and act and say just the right thing all of the time so that people understand you. Sometimes they're going to not understand. Sometimes they're going to misinterpret you. Sometimes they'll be offended. And as long as we're rooted in God's love for us, we're able to tolerate that experience. And third, certainty in a person versus faith that embraces questions. Certainty is about looking to someone, like a contemporary person, someone we can reach out and touch to be the answer button. This could be a well-meaning pastor, or they could be a cult leader. This person could be your parent, or they could be a predator. But this is about giving up your agency, your own sense of responsibility, your critical thinking, and letting someone else tell you how to think and what to believe. And on the flip side, a mature faith is one that embraces questions. Like we like to say here at Sycamore Creek that you don't have to check your brains at the door. We embrace question asking and curiosity as a way of approaching each other, the world, and our faith. And this is because we rest in the love of God, the relationship we have with God, and not the things that we believe with our mind. We recognize that part of a mature faith is learning to live without firm assurances, without all of our questions being answered, without everything being nailed down. We can embrace those questions. And as a bonus, mature faith involves freedom to be gracious and giving. We don't live with a scarcity mindset. We know that God's love is so abundant, and so we live and love abundantly. We're concerned with the welfare of other people, looking out for each other. Maybe there are times that our faith starts with what's in it for me, but that's not where we end. We move from that I to you. So let's pause here for another chat question. Where has your faith allowed you to be more gracious and giving? This mindset of work hard and earn success, desires, rest, is pervasive. I'm sure I'm not the only person who has a vague sense of guilt for taking time to rest. So this is our good news. You don't have to do anything special for God to want to have a relationship with you. You don't have to work hard to convince Jesus to go the extra mile for you. You don't have to earn God's love. It's already yours. The younger son in the story from Luke's gospel, he realized this. He remembers that the father is the answer, and then he confronts his problem. The son repents and turns toward home, finding that his father's love is deeper and more gracious than he ever imagined, and it's already his. So this is our good news. If your life has obvious problems, Jesus is the answer, and he already loves you. And if your life is pretty good, Jesus is the answer, and he already loves you. No matter where you're at today, whether your life is falling apart around you or you feel like things are going pretty well. God loves you so much, and you don't have to earn or work for it. That love is already yours. And there's an invitation to grow in gratitude and compassion and love in response to God's love for you. Jesus is the answer, and He already loves you.